It's got all the makings of a tabloid headline or an action movie. The son of one of America's richest families travels to an exotic locale, disappears under mysterious circumstances, and is rumored to have been eaten by cannibals. Was it true, or did he drown, as the official reports claimed? Journalist Carl Hoffman was determined to find out what actually happened to Michael C. Rockefeller. The 21-year-old son of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller was never seen again after he went missing in New Guinea back in 1961. Hoffman retraced Rockefeller's journey, combed through archives, and interviewed eyewitnesses to come to his own conclusions, which he writes about in Savage Harvest, a tale of cannibals, colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's tragic quest. Carl, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much.
So did I set that Rockefeller story up correctly there?
Yes, no question. I mean, Michael graduated. He was the son of Nelson, who was the governor of New York at the time, and he graduated from Harvard and went off to New Guinea to work on a film, and his father had opened the Museum of Primitive Art, as it was called then, a few years earlier, and Michael was a trustee. And while he was in New Guinea, he heard about a people called the Azmat, who lived on the southwest coast and were incredible carvers. And he determined to go to Azmat and try to collect some Azmat art, which he did. He made a quick sort of a reconnaissance journey of a few weeks, and then went back to the film. And then when that was done, he decided to go back for a couple months. And on that trip, he vanished.
So Michael Rockefeller was 21 years old. This was back in 1961. In your studying of this, did it seem to you like he was just a buccaneer looking for this indigenous art to bring home to his primitive art museum? Or did he really become enamored with the culture and just wanted to learn more about it and connect with it?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I don't think Michael was much of a buccaneer. He was a young, earnest man, very smart, well-educated. He'd grown up around art, you know, the way most American kids have grown up around baseball and, you know, some of the greatest art of the world. He was enamored of and fascinated by Azmat culture and Azmat carving. I mean, you know, the best of the carving, the most spectacular of these things were, you know, 23, 24 foot high poles, kind of like totem poles, if you will. I think he had an earnest interest in it. I mean, you know, at the same time, he was young, he was inexperienced, he was wealthy. He, you know, got access and breaks that a regular person wouldn't have had. And certainly those things contributed to the disaster that he fell into.
And this is in New Guinea. This is a huge island down between Thailand and Indonesia. It's one of the most remote places on Earth, really. How do you go there and find an artistic treasure and then buy it to bring it home? What's the mechanics of that?
Well, at the time, it was known as Netherlands New Guinea. It was Dutch New Guinea, the last Dutch colony of the East Indies. And that, of course, made it a little bit easier for him. But the region that he went to was Azmat. It's 10,000, even today, it's 10,000 square miles of roadless swamp. In the inner villages, there are no stores, no plumbing, no electricity. He bought a boat from a Dutch colonial patrol officer, sort of a two dugout canoes with a little bit of a sort of Huck Finn-like cabin on top, and with a Dutch miner, a 34-year-old anthropologist named Rene Wassing, and two local boys. They just went off from village to village, you know, and they would arrive in the village and say they were interested in stuff, and people would bring it out. But you have to understand, in 1961, Azmat was an incredibly remote place. Really, Western contact had just been made in the late 1950s, and the Azmat were a people of great artistic passion and power, but they were also constant warfare with each other and lived in a world of this sacred reciprocal violence of which the art was all a part. And, you know, and headhunting was an integral part of their culture. And part of that headhunting, you know, was also some cannibalism. And Michael unwittingly stepped into a very complex political world. And he ended up at the wrong place at the wrong time.
And, you know, you could be very wealthy and sophisticated, but from a cultural point of view, you could also be very naive and green, venturing into a society like this.
one of the great ironies of the story is that, you know, this is a man from who represents, you know, the most powerful family in the most powerful country in the world. And in Azmat, at the crucial moment, he was the least powerful man in all the world. And, you know, cannibalism is all about intimacy and power. And it's all about taking somebody's power and headhunting. And, you know, when the Azmat men who killed him did so, they were taking back their power. It was sort of a desperate bid to take power back that had been usurped by Dutch colonialists and Dutch efforts to pacify them and take away their culture. And they consumed him. And there's no more articulate display of power than that.
So did they eat Rockefeller thinking they were just eating a white guy that represented colonialism, or did they know they were eating a man from the most powerful family in the most powerful white country?
No, they didn't know anything about the Rockefellers. The Rockefeller name meant nothing to them. I mean, it's a complex story that, in a nutshell, in 1957, as I said, the Dutch were trying to pacify the Azmat, mm-hmm. and in 1957, there was a war between two villages, and many men were killed, mm-hmm. Local men, you know, they killed each other, and a very aggressive, racist Dutch colonial patrol officer went to the village specifically to teach the village a lesson, as he wrote in his reports, and he was afraid, and he brought a lot of armed policemen with him, and he arrived into this village of Ochnep, which was a legendary, you know, a traditional place, a place that had resisted the incursions of the Dutch and didn't want to change its ways. Why should it? Why would it want to? He ended up opening fire and killing five people, and that left the village with a sacred obligation to, you know, everything was awry, I mean, spiritually, and it left the village with a sacred obligation to reciprocate the men's death, and Michael kind of swam into that, as it turned out.
So he gave them the opportunity to reciprocate, basically, by stumbling into their world.
He did.
Carl Hoffman's been on assignment to more than 70 countries as a reporter. Today on Travel with Rick Steves, he's telling us what he discovered about the plight of Michael C. Rockefeller as he investigated his disappearance and a deadly clash between cultures in the jungles of New Guinea. His book is called Savage Harvest. Now, I guess I am focusing on cannibalism because it's fascinating and apparently it's a reality. But I guess when these tribal people decide to eat a human being, it's not a matter of nutrition. It's not like the Donner Party. It's a matter of power and symbolism. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not like, you know, we're hungry, let's go get a Big Mac or anything.
No, because it's easier to get an animal in that regard, but you're just asserting yourself by symbolically ritualistically eating somebody.
Yeah, it gets very complex, but, mm-hmm. you know, cannibalism is a sacred act within mm-hmm. a complex web of obligation and ceremony and customary laws, and that has great meaning and importance.
Is there a ritualistic way to actually cook the person?
Yes, very much so, which I won't go into here, but I do in the book.
The Rockefeller family maintains that their son was not a victim of cannibals.
Well, he was actually on a boat crossing the mouth of a river that had engine trouble and then flipped over and drifted. And Michael said, you know, I think he violated the first law of yachting, which is to, you know, never leave the boat as long as it's still afloat. And mm-hmm. he said, I think I can make it. And Renee Wassing, who was older and wiser, said, you know, if you go, you're on your own. I'm not leaving. And Michael did. And he swam away from the boat and he was never seen again. And there was a massive search. And, of course, Rene was rescued the following day by Dutch patrol planes. Mm-hmm. There was a massive search for Michael. You know, Nelson and Michael's sister, Mary, both went to New Guinea immediately, and a fairly sophisticated search for him, and no trace of him was ever found. So it was natural to assume that he had disappeared. And, of course, Rene had seen him swim off, mm-hmm. that he disappeared at sea. But as it turned out, very soon afterwards, there were Dutch missionaries who had been living among villagers for years and spoke the local language and began making their rounds and hearing reports that Michael had, in fact, made it to shore and encountered men from this very specific village, and that he had been killed. And they actually investigated it fairly thoroughly and wrote detailed reports. I mean, so detailed they named names, who had his thigh, who had ribs, you know, who had his glasses. Those reports they filed both to their superiors in the Catholic Church and to the Dutch government, and those were, and the Dutch government ultimately actually dispatched another patrol officer to the village to do an official investigation, which he did, and all of those reports were squashed and never went anywhere. For many years, it wasn't unreasonable for the Rockefeller family to assume that he had, in fact, died at sea, as they were told. Later, there were rumors began to surface publicly, and ultimately, like in my book, I mean, there are, you know, I found huge amounts of documents and archival, all this original contemporaneous stuff that many people had never seen before. But, you know, they're
leading you to conclude that he had been a victim of cannibals. Reporter Carl Hoffman's assignments have taken him to some of the world's riskier places. He investigates the disappearance of Michael C. Rockefeller in the jungles of New Guinea in his book, Savage Harvest. In Carl's latest book, he immerses himself in the world of President Trump's most ardent followers at his MAGA rallies. It's called Liar's Circus. There's more on his website at carlhoffman.com, and that's Carl with a C. So, Carl, the Rockefeller story is so fascinating, and related to that is just the opportunity to actually travel there. And I've never encountered a country that says, travel here, and if you step out of the off the track, you can be eaten by the locals. Is there actually tourism in this part of New Guinea, and today is it safe to travel there? And are there still tribes that maintain these traditions that was the doom of Rockefeller?
It's certainly possible to travel almost anywhere in the island of New Guinea. Azmat is still very remote and is difficult to get to. The Azmat are all Catholics today. There's been no cannibalism since the early 1960s, so it's certainly safe in that way. You know, you can go, but it is definitely expensive and difficult.
You know, one of my most rich travel experiences was traveling to New Guinea, flying into the middle of that island. It was Papua New Guinea. You were talking about the other half of the island, but I imagine it's essentially the same culture. And I was just fascinated by the people I met and the tight communities and the humor and the music and the traditions that were still vivid. And a traveler could actually experience those. You could sit on a log with somebody chewing a betel nut, and a little kid ran by, and the man knew what kid it was by the footprint he left in the sand. As a community that was so tight, I understood there's no local word for orphan. Everybody takes care of everybody.
Mm-hmm. And in Azmat, there are fantastic drummers and singers and dancers. And, you know, sometimes they will drum and sing for 24 hours straight all through the night. And it's a really fantastic, a beautiful, it kind of takes you into a different world. And, you know, it's one of those things that I'll never forget.
There is a lot of missionary influence. And I felt there was actually competing missionary groups from different Christian denominations. And, you know, this would be Baptist, this would be Lutheran, this would be Catholic, and so on. It has a huge impact on the community. What was your experience in that regard?
Absolutely. Well, traditionally, at least in West Papua, the Protestants took the highlands and the Catholics took the coasts. You know, for a long time in Azmat, first there were Dutch missionaries, and then those were replaced by Americans after Indonesia took over from the Dutch, even in Papua in 1962. And today, there are fewer American missionaries. Most of those missionaries most of the Catholic officials are, the bishop is a local man. But, you know, most of those people are often very, very strong Catholics, but they're Catholics with multiple wives and, you know, one foot in one world and one foot in another.
Yeah. And I think the modern missionary work is a little more sensitive than the old Bras and Bibles days. And I know when I was there, the Lutheran Church from the First World was actually bringing in missionaries from Madagascar in a tropics-to-tropics kind of work, because they understood the tempo of society and the respect for the local big man. And it was a much more thoughtful kind of international compassion, I think.
I mean, the Catholic Church in Azmat, where Michael Rockefeller disappeared, played a fairly strong role in actually encouraging the resumption of ceremonies and carving that had been banned by the Indonesians.
So more sensitive to the indigenous culture, I suppose.
Indeed.
This is so interesting to grapple with this as a first world traveler. And for a lot of people, there's this this sort of ethical struggle. Do we want to bring the comforts and the education and the health care and the modern medicine to these primitive communities and call it civilization? Or is it more correct and more ethical just to stay away and let them continue in their traditional ways? Let's finish our conversation on New Guinea just with your take on that ethical issue.
Well, I think it's a powerful issue. I don't think it's as simple and black and white as you make it out to be. I don't think, you know, first thing is not to call them primitive. I mean, they're technologically not as developed, but they're very complex societies that are every bit as complex as Western cultures. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, it's not about what we want. It's not about imposing our own sense of development on people, but traveling sensitively and listening to people and listening to what they want and what they need and what their struggles are, rather than, you know, using words like civilization or primitive and imposing our own values and beliefs on them.
How much time did you spend in New Guinea in your work with Savage Harvest?
I made two-month trips.
And of that 4 months you spent in New Guinea as an American travel writer, what was the thing that kind of shook up your ethnocentrism and gained you a respect for that culture? Is there any particular example you could share?
Well, I think when I lived in the village of Birien Ochinep for a month, and I lived with a family and a man who was the head of that family, Kokai, and, you know, I think everything about that experience was pretty profound. You know, I think for me, someone who has had this long fascination with indigenous people, and, you know, we tend to think of them in very, you know, we project our own fantasies upon them and mm-hmm. imagine them as exotic or as objects, really. I think we mm-hmm. tend to fetishize them. And my experience living with them was just that they're complex, three-dimensional people who can't be easily put in a jar, and then mm-hmm. we need to look at them in a much broader way. And
it's
much
a big
more
challenge for first-world travelers, and you become particularly aware of that when you go to an amazing and rich and yet remote culture like one you'd find on New Guinea.
And yet that's why it's, you know, you can argue that it's so important to make that journey.
Yeah. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Carl Hoffman. His book is Savage Harvest. Carl, thanks so much. I'm glad that you had this fascination in the Rockefeller story. And in writing this book, you're able to give us a better understanding and a better appreciation of the indigenous cultures in New Guinea.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for letting me share.
You bet. Whether you travel far from home or just across the street, we'd still like to hear about your travels in the form of a haiku poem. Here are some original haiku our listeners have sent us from the link on the radio page at ricksteves.com.
Jim Snyder from Chuliota, Florida, came up with this haiku at the Paul Brown Stadium on the riverfront in Cincinnati while watching a Bengals football game. Ohio River, bratwurst mustard on my nose, scenic Roebling Bridge. Roy Barnes of Cheyenne, Wyoming, writes about the approach of fall in the Entlebuch region of Switzerland. Mist over the moors. Daylight goes gray, yearning for fall to turn hopeful. And Jory Slodke from Raleigh, North Carolina, remembers the fun she had watching one of the performances at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Puppets reenact Pulp Fiction with tiny guns. Strings tangle, limbs fly.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Thanks to KNPR Las Vegas and National Public Radio in Washington for studio help, and to Gretchen Straub for reading our listener travel haiku. Jim Hinckley tells us about a recurring Old West ghost sighting from the back roads of Arizona in an extra to this week's show. You'll find it at ricksteves.com/radio.